This is the Reading Envy Podcast, where we'll have what you're reading. Hello and welcome to the allergen-free back corner of the Reading Envy Pub.
Hello.
Hello, Jenny. How are you?
Good, Scott. How are you?
Just fine.
Well, we're bringing back a guest today who has already visited us at Reading Envy.
Ooh, our first double guest or return guest.
Repeat offender,
yes.
Welcome back,
we'll have
Frank.
To put his picture on the wall of the Reading Envy pub.
I think you should. Well, thanks. It's good to be back.
Hey, welcome. Have you been up to anything? See, last time we talked to you, well, it's not like it's changed. You're still an education consultant. Is that correct?
Futurist.
Right. I'm a consulting futurist is a term I like to use.
Excellent. Okay. Excellent. I'm sure, again, there's still a lot of very interesting things. I follow you on Twitter. I'm always interested in what you've got going there. As a former school board member, I'm particularly interested in what's going on, not only at, because you're a school board member as well, so not only in the higher education, but in the
K-12.
Yeah, exactly, the K-12 as well.
Now, where were you on the school board?
I was on the school board in Idaho.
Uh-huh.
A little town called Malad, Idaho, Malad City.
That must have been interesting.
It was. There was a lot of one-to-one initiatives and all that stuff going on here, which, you know, they were really because of a lot of the rural things. But anyway, but that's not why we're here. But yet I find it interesting. I urge you to follow Brian on Twitter if that interests you.
Oh, thanks. You guys should follow Scott.
Heck yeah. So we're here today to talk about what, Jenny?
Well, Brian and I started talking in an email about the different ways people read. And I thought, you know, this would be a really good topic for a podcast. Well, actually, you might have thought of that, Brian. I don't remember. But we were talking about how people come to reading from different perspectives. And so I thought maybe we could just each talk about how we read on our own first.
Okay.
The hows. Who would like to start?
Well, I can certainly do that. Well, reading has been with me since, in the last podcast, I was talking to my daughter and my niece about YA fiction, and I mentioned a book called Dolphin Island, and that was the first book that sort of changed reading for me. Then, when I started to review books in 2003 or so at sffaudio.com, that changed how I read again. And then when we started to do a podcast at SFF Audio, that changed how I read again. And that has sort of stuck with me. So the way that I read now is, you know, I take notes while I read. And I've found that writing the notes in longhand is the best way for me. I've gone back and forth between digital and a pen over and over and over for years. But I'm back in a notebook, and I think a notebook's where I need to be. So what I usually do is I can mark places with post-it notes or whatever, but I usually write down quotes and things that I want to save in a notebook that I have. Is that an answer to your question, or are you looking for something different
definitely.
Than that? Yeah. But that's a method
track.
That I read. Yeah, I keep track because I've found that when I read something in order to discuss it or knowing that a discussion is going to take place, it changes how I read.
Uh-huh.
And it changes it for the better. And one of the reasons I like doing this podcast is because it focuses my reading. I tend to get very scattered. You know, I have lists and I say, you know, today this list looks terrific and tomorrow that list looks terrific. And, this one helps me finish books because I start a lot of books that I don't finish. I'm not a person that thinks that I need to finish something if it's not connecting with me in some way. But being on this podcast or SFF Audio or Good Story, I tend to push through it. And sometimes that's very rewarding. It's ended up, I've discovered a lot of things that way.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's all, it's, you know, podcasting, discussing books has become a necessary thing. It's like a book is not finished anymore unless I talk to somebody about it.
Yeah.
I remember a long time ago when I was thinking about this, somebody in just a throwaway line in a lecture in college said, something about, you know, reading books is worthless unless you talk to somebody about it. And that always stuck in my head, even though I kept reading them and not talking to people about them. And then I had a good friend who we were having a discussion one time, and he said, you know, if you don't talk to somebody about your ideas, you can start to get some pretty wacky ideas that don't make any sense when you say them out loud, because they're all kind of in your head and you're brewing them, and it sounds perfectly reasonable to you. But then when you speak to someone, it's pretty apparent that, well, that's not going to work, you know? And I found that to be really true. And then now when I read a book, it's like, you know, who's read this? Has anybody read this? Because I would like to talk to somebody about it, because somehow that finishes the book for me, and it doesn't quite feel done unless I do. I don't write a lot of reviews anymore, but I love discussing them.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm the same way on that last point.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was frustrated today because I finished a book that I don't quite get. And I went looking for what my friends had to say about it, and very few of them had read it, at least in Goodreads. And I was like, how am I going to understand this book?
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing, you know, it almost every single time when I discuss a book, it comes away and I feel better about it. I, you know, like if I rate a book, you know, 3 stars, and then I talk about it, I usually am like, well, that was probably a 4-star book or 3.5, you know, because I start to understand it more. And I'm like, oh, you know what? That was kind of neat what the author did here or there.
Yeah.
But,
have but either yeah. of you read Speedboat?
Not me.
I've never heard of it.
I have not.
Darn.
On reviews, if I could touch on that, I got to a point where it was really, really easy to write a review of something I loved. And it's also pretty easy to write a review of something that I really disliked. But this middle area, it became kind of drivelish is what I was writing. It was like, you know, this was, you know, if you like Star Wars, you'd like this maybe, or, you know, trying to just think of something to write about it in a review. I just started to feel that, well, that's not really worth my time anymore. You know, because they became, after you write so many, it just becomes something that's, well, let me just think of a way to fill up a page with something about this book, you know, but when I discuss it, I feel differently about that. And I'm sure that that's the social aspect rather than the solitary aspect of a review.
That's a nice distinction.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a real social aspect to it now, which when I started reading, there wasn't, I don't recall friends and things when I was in high school that I would read and we would all read the same book. You know, there was a few books that floated around that everybody read, like, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was always floating around. Lord of the Rings was always floating around. So that was a common experience there. But past that, it wasn't like everybody was reading the same books, or I could even find people that I knew that read those books. I knew readers, but we weren't always reading the same things. But now it's a very social thing for me. You know, I finish a book and I'm like, I can't wait to talk to somebody about this or put it on the podcast or you know, just any of those things. It has really become social. How about for you guys?
I've got a weird background, and that makes everything I do really social.
Uh-huh.
When I was in my 20s, I worked at a used bookshop, and it was a great bookstore. This is in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I was constantly interacting with people, and people were always coming up to me saying, you know, what do you recommend here? What do you recommend there? And the bookstore owner and the staff were all, you know, book lovers. And it's one of the great things about used bookshops is they tend to employ people who are book fiends. So it was always, always social in that sense. And then when I left the bookstore, I got my doctorate and became an English professor. So, you know, I had to be social. Otherwise, they wouldn't pay me. And, right. and so I always thought about reading in terms of teaching and research. So for the former, interacting with students about books, and then for the latter, interacting with professional colleagues around the world. And since then, I live, gosh, I think out loud through social media so much. It's such a key part of my life that reading is a real part of that. I think the only place I don't really talk about books is on Twitter very much. Mm-hmm. I just haven't had a lot of traction for that when I mention books. About a year ago, we had this experiment where we had the Exploded Twitter Book Club, and we had some discussions, but it didn't go too long. Mm-hmm. I'd like to do more of that. So yeah. It's funny. I mean, books are, in Western culture, books are, I think it was Kurt Vonnegut said that books are kind of our, the closest thing we have to meditation in the Eastern culture sense. You know, that we really, it's solitary, it's individual. You cut off the world and you dive deep into something. And I really feel that when I read, but then I've got to bust out of that and tell people about it.
Yeah, yeah, and I feel the same, and that surprises me. You know, if you knew me back in high school, you know, I was very introverted, and I would have been content just reading it and thinking, you know, that was great. What's next? But now it's much different and better, I might add.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. I'm not. I guess the only downside is it takes more time for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I read this book that I really enjoyed, finished it yesterday, and wrote a Goodreads review on it. And this always happens to me when I'm writing a Goodreads review, that it's like I lose track of what I'm doing, and then suddenly it's four screens later, and I've got, you know, massively hyperlinked and extensive discussion with spoiler tags all over the place. I'm like, all right, gotta stop. It's fun. I love it.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah.
And well, Jenny, what was that? I'm just curious what book that was.
Oh, this was a science fiction novel from about 14 years ago by Jack Womack, and it's called Going, Going, Gone. Hmm. Jack Womack is this kind of a cult author right now. He writes, and people usually call him speculative fiction because he doesn't feel like an SF writer. He wrote a seven book series that's kind of comic dystopia based on a future. You know, one of those science fiction worlds that could never happen, where corporations dominate the earth, shadowy terrorist threats curtail civil liberties, the economy is bad. You know, it's one of those far future things that we wouldn't know about. And each of the books whack at this from different angles, and they're beautifully written, both really scary and dark, and also very funny. And they often involve time travel. So the most famous one is called Elvisy, and it's in the far future. There's a church of Elvis, and the economy is so bad that everyone's favorite Elvis is late Elvis, because he's so fat. That's a good if you're starving. That's an attractive thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the company goes back in the past to kidnap Elvis and bring him into the future as a kind of a living messiah.
Ah, that explains his disappearance.
You understand. It all ties together.
Yeah.
So I've talked with a guy on Twitter, actually, because Womack is really funny. He's really important. We've had some fun exchanges. So it was, it was kind of a treat to read. Mm. He also, he wrote a hilarious Russian novel called Let's Put the Future Behind Us, which is all about you know, post-Soviet Russia with, you know, criminal gangs and slapstick comedy. It was brilliant.
I have dim memories of a book by James Moreau called This is the Way the World Ends. You happen to have read that? It was excellent. I couldn't tell you a lot of details. It's been so long, but I remember reading it and thinking, wow, this is really something. This is the same guy who wrote Towing Jehovah, which was about God dying and falling into the ocean. There was another one, The City of Truth, which was about a place where people can't lie. Very interesting.
Yeah, very prolific guy.
He is, and he's comic, very satirical against religion. Very, very interesting writer.
He had a short story I heard on, I think it was on Escape Pod. It was a short story about the Abominable Snowman. It was hilarious. You know, very, really well written.
Nice, nice.
But like you, I believe in taking notes. I got into that as a grad student, and it was a hedge against memory, so I remember things. And Jenny, did I tell you the pension story about this?
Yeah, but I think you should share it with everyone.
All right. See, this is the thing with Thomas Pynchon. Pynchon's one of those weird guys that Pynchon fans always have weird stories about, and there are tons of them. There's like myth cycles about Pynchon. You know, he's still alive, as far as we can tell, you know, American writer. Actually, there's a movie. The first movie of a Pynchon book is coming out. It's in production. It's called Inherent Vice. And the director is Anderson. Thomas Anderson? Can't think of his name. Anyway, I was in grad school. I was reading his his greatest book called Gravity's Rainbow. And if you haven't read it, it's almost impossible to describe. It takes place in World War II and involves almost everything. The joke used to be you could assign this book to a first-year student at college because it had everything. It had history. It had language. It has chemistry. It has film history. It has geography.
Romance. Literature.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, lots of romance, good and bad. And it's a musical.
Yeah, I read The Crying of Lot 39.
Yeah,
39. 49. Yes.
Yeah, we talked about it. So I was reading this book and really getting into it, and then I got in an accident. I had a concussion. And when I came to, I had lost memory. And for roughly the next day and a half, my memory was kind of coming back online in fits and starts. And I have yet to recover all the memory from that. For example, I don't remember the accident itself. And after an accident like that, you get lots of second-person narratives aimed at you. You know, what happened? Well, you did this, and you did that, and you did that. And that's kind of discomforting. But the key thing was I went to my backpack, opened it up. There's Gravity's Rainbow, and I'd been annotating it as I went along. And I couldn't remember what I'd read at all. I looked at the book, and it was suddenly totally opaque to me. I couldn't remember the plot. I couldn't remember characters, nothing. And then I riffled through the pages, and I'd been annotating it heavily. And some of the annotations didn't make sense to me. And this is creepy and unsettling and eerie by itself, but Pynchon's a guy who is obsessed with paranoia, obsessed with conspiracy. He's like almost like a kind of Phil Dick level mentality. So, in fact, the Gravity's Rainbow actually has a limerick dedicated to paranoia, which is a musical limerick. And so this made it even more disturbing. So that kind of fixed in place for me the importance of note-taking. Go ahead.
Sorry, you like to take notes in the books you're reading?
Yes. Usually pen. And I have a scheme of things, a little code. So if there's an embedded story, I put L1 where it begins and where it ends. And if there's an embedded story within that, I put L2 and so on, because I've studied embedded narratives, and I think they're fascinating. I think in many ways an embedded story is when a novel really, or any story, really acquires depth to it. It works almost unconsciously. And then if I'm teaching the book or if I'm using it for some purpose, then I actually enter all my notes into an index file, print it out, and tape it to the book so you can have that. This is my great mentor and friend Eric Rabkin, professor at the University of Michigan, science fiction and fantasy expert. He was the one who got me into this, and it's totally worth it. And then I add to it as it goes along.
Cool.
That may be more detail than you wanted to know, but
no.
I would love to see a picture of one of these. You know, like I just want to see it. That'd be really neat.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
It's kind of dull looking, but yeah. And then I took to using Post-it notes. I wish Julie were here so I could talk to her about this. I got stuck teaching the Bible as literature when I was in grad school. And I say got stuck because I didn't volunteer for it. I was assigned to it. And I had zero experience. I had not been raised in a religious household, had never read the book. And so I panicked. I had this quick summer where I had to dive into the Bible as literature and prepare myself to teach it.
Wow. Yeah.
It was wild. I had all kinds of crazy experiences teaching it, good and bad. But one of the things that disturbed me, I was studying literature of war at the time, and I was gobsmacked by the level of violence in the Bible, passages of extreme gore or terror and physical violence. I mean, this is a cliche, everyone knows this, but mm-hmm. but it really bothered me. So I started putting a little post-it note wherever one of those passages occurred. It bothered me. So the first half of my Oxford Bible looks like an accordion. All these post-it notes, you know, for every time a bear attacks or, you know, Yahweh blows up a town. I mean, it's just, so that's kind of like, I should take a picture of that. It's like my most stickied book.
Yes. That's great.
I mark up my books a lot too, but I get paranoid that the sticky note stuff will come off. Mm-hmm. And so like when I spent a summer reading Infinite Jest 2 years ago with a group online, and every maybe 100 pages or so, I'd go back through and I'd type up all the bits I had marked and I'd take out all the sticky notes.
Yeah,
so now I don't have that like tangible record. I have to have the document next to the book, which I wish that I had it written in there, you know, because I own the book.
So is the document in print form or electronic form?
I think I did it in a Google Doc.
Uh-huh.
And then so then it's not even really linked to my review. See, it's kind of scattered. I really would like to find a way where I could pull that stuff more together.
That's the biggest single obstacle to ebooks taking off in education, is difficulties in annotating them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if we can solve that, that'll just change everything.
Yeah. I've done podcasts on novels that I've read on a Kindle, and I have found it to be handy. When you highlight things, you mm-hmm. can go to Amazon, what is it, kindle.amazon.com, and mm-hmm. log into your thing, and you can see all your notes.
I love that.
Yeah, so you can, it's really easy to pull out of there.
Well, I just did that this morning. The, mm-hmm. the book I was writing a review of, I have the Kindle e-reader, so I just clicked the view my notes, and it was like every bookmark and every highlight was just right there uh-huh. in a second. It was great. You can't do that in print.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think of the feature that you can see the most highlighted things as you're reading?
I love it.
Do you? Yeah, and I thought that's kind of interesting, too. Every now and then I run across that, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. You know, 112 highlights of this passage, you know.
I'll tell you, I love used books, and mm-hmm. not just because I used to work in a store, and not just because they're cheaper, that's a win, but I love the little physical embedded history of them.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I'll get one, and it'll have comments, and if I'm really lucky, it'll have two different people's comments. I just find that really neat to see what they notice and if they react to each other.
Oh,
and
that so is cool.
Well, with the Kindle, as you say, I love this feeling of I'm reading and suddenly I'm in a crowd of strangers, of shadows, and I'm reading, and they're also over my shoulder, and it gives the book a kind of electric level to it. I love that because it tells me what people are noticing and thinking. The downside, though, and it took me years to get over this, is that the more highlights, the more annotations in a book, the less it's, the lower its value in the marketplace.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to get over that. And Jenny, that's what I thought you were going to say when you said that, you know, you said you were worried about, and I thought you were, instead of saying sticky notes losing their glue, I thought you were going to say marking something up. Especially because you work in a library and you shouldn't be marking the library book.
Well, and that's part of it, is that most of the time I am reading library books because I only buy books that I know I love. It's mm-hmm. kind of my own little thing I do. And so, yeah, often I'm using someone else's book. And honestly, I'm a very bad librarian. I'm not supposed to be using post-it notes in books. But I do it very temporarily, you see. I don't know how else to do it.
Well, let me come to you with a possible confession, and you can absolve me or condemn me.
Okay.
You are now. Is it okay for patrons or users to fold over pages in a library book?
You'll have to do 3 hail pigeons.
Oh, I'll gladly do that.
I don't really know what's worse. The thing that I have on my desk right now is a pile of little tiny slips of paper, because when I'm trying to be good, I shred up a piece of paper and mark all the pages. But as you can imagine, that's even worse than post-it notes. And then I write up my notes about it, and then I end up with these piles. I look like I'm like a mouse making a nest or something.
That's great.
I just need to buy the books and mark them up. That would be better.
Yep. Well, I feel the... Well, thank you for answering that question. Now my soul trembles in this purgatory. But I feel the something kind of akin to this when I'm listening to audiobooks. I mean, just tonight, I was I spent an hour splitting wood. So I've been doing for the past 2 months. We've got a lot of we heat entirely by wood, so we've got huge amounts of wood. And I've got my MP3 player on, and in my ears are podcasts. And this time it was Julie reading Uncle Tom's Cabin. So I'm listening to this, and I'm nodding, I'm enjoying it, and I have no way to respond. You know, I can't. It's an MP3 player. It's uninteractive, right? You know, all I can do is pause it or skip it, but I can't type in something. And all I have to do is remember it. And I find sometimes when I listen to a podcast, depending on where I am, I'll race for scrap paper and quickly jot something down so that I'll remember to do it later, and it doesn't always work. I've actually done that when I'm driving. You know, I'll have a piece of paper and I'll squash it on the steering column and just quickly jot something down. And when I pull over, I can't read what I wrote because it's all over the place. But it's weird.
I was just going to say, I have that same problem.
Well, what do you do?
Well, and there's a difference too. If you're listening to audiobooks in Audible, that has the option of, you know, making a bookmark and making a note, although if you're driving, not so good, probably. But, you know, sometimes I'm listening to things I've ripped, or I'm actually listening to a CD at regular speed, and it drives me crazy. And so then I try to remember what I was remembering, and then sometimes I'll go look in Google Books, like, for the exact quote, for instance, because sometimes if you do a phrase search, it'll bring you just to that page. It won't let you read the whole book, but you can get the words back. This doesn't always work, and then I'm having to go back through. That drives me nuts.
Yeah, I've reviewed a whole lot of audiobooks over at SFF Audio, and I've had that problem so many times. And I've gone through, you know, carrying a notebook with me all the time. I've, you know, once I got a smartphone, I would do things like either by voice, record something, and usually just a short note, or just noting a time. That, you know, I need to get back to this spot. But you're right. I've never had anything satisfying on that front. There's always nothing. I haven't found anything ideal except for, excuse me, that was my phone. But I haven't found an ideal solution to that. But bookmarking is something I haven't even tried, but I use, an old iPod, one of those thumb wheel ones, which I just love. It's like the perfect device. So there's really no way to bookmark in that one.
Can you listen to Audible on MP3 player?
Yeah.
But does it have that bookmarking feature built in?
It doesn't. You have to have some kind of a smart device to have that feature.
Like a laptop or a tablet or a phone? A
laptop or a tablet or a phone, right.
Yep. I just started listening to some podcasts on Stitcher. And I wonder if I can do that.
It's possible. It's possible. But yeah, that's always an issue. And you know what's funny about audiobooks? Have you guys ever had the experience where you return somewhere where you were listening to an audiobook that you were really into, and you remember the audiobook very, very well from that spot?
Yes, isn't that the weirdest
thing? I've had
that
too, yeah.
I do this with space. Like, there's a... In a Vermont route, 107, there's a spot where late one night I was listening to an audiobook of history, medieval history. And for some reason, whenever it's at nighttime, I'm driving through that stretch of 107, I remember this discussion about the onset of the Black Death.
Yeah.
And there's nothing, it's a beautiful spot. There's nothing bubonic about that stretch of 107.
Yeah.
And various places around my land, you know, a certain wood pile, a certain pile of rocks, I'll think, that reminds me of a skate pod, or...
Yeah. Yeah, I was building a manufacturing plant one time in the previous job I had, and I spent a lot of long hours, you know, there in that last month getting ready, and I was wiring control panels, so it was tedious work, so I could just listen to audiobooks, and And whenever I'm in there, I remember The Shining by Stephen King, which came out on audio. You know, I had it brand new, you know, for SFF audio. And then I also remember a book called The Road to Dune, which was by Brian Herbert, which collected all of, you know, Frank Herbert's, you know, this is how Dune came to be. Here's some early versions. Here's a journal and all that stuff. I loved it. I thought it was a terrific book. But those two books are just crystal clear every time I walk in that building.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have this road that, because I have the worst sense of direction of anyone I know, I drove the whole length of the road instead of turning off of it, which added an hour to my commute that day. If I go back on that road, I remember The Ice Queen by Alice Hoffman, which is what I was listening to that day.
Oh, cool. Huh.
So, and I won't even remember having read that book necessarily, and then I'll turn on that road and there it is in my head. Yeah. It's amazing.
That's incredible. That's incredible. All three of us have that.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah, and I've lost my ability to listen to audiobooks almost 100%. I don't know. I think it's just because of my life right now is just...
It'll come back.
So busy, yeah. But I am constantly putting in an audiobook, and it's a half an hour later, and I have no idea what happened.
Oh.
Yeah. I think it's just that I'm preoccupied. But I've gone through periods like this before. But usually, you know, I find a really good one that I can connect with, and then that comes back. So I will await that. But at the moment, I'm not having any success. Although I am listening to Roger Ebert's biography in my van, and I'm finding it very interesting.
Have you gotten to Beyond the Valley of the Dolls yet?
No, not yet. He's still in... he just talked about his mom. You know, there's a chapter on his dad, and there was a chapter on his mom. And, you know, this is the first time I've tried this, which may be hard to believe, but I was just at the library the other day. I grabbed this audiobook and I put it in and I'm listening to it. And, you know, my commute is so short. I mean, I live 15 minutes away. If I drive, so I'm listening to this book in 15 minute pieces and, I'm finding it really, it's working just fine. I really enjoy it.
Why is it, do you think?
I'm not sure. It may be just the subject matter. Good reader, very interesting subject. I think that may be it. It could be that the audiobooks that I keep attempting are a little bit too complicated for audio. Not everything works on audio, I've found. If I have like a particularly dense piece of fiction, like, for example, let's say The Book of the New Sun by Gene Wolfe.
Yeah.
I had a tough time on audio. I got the first one and I was all ready to review that thing and I'm listening to it and I just found it difficult on audio. It's much better in print. Even though the narrator was fantastic. Really? Jonathan Davis, yeah. It's available on Audible.
Oh, it's a magnificent book.
Yeah, it's four audiobooks actually. They did split it up into the four volumes, but yeah, I found it hard on audio.
He wrote a little spin-off book, mostly of essays about it, called The Castle of the Otter.
Yeah.
because the third book, I think, is called The Citadel of the Autark.
Right.
And it had been misprinted in a review of Citadel of the Otter. and he was just taken by that.
I love it.
No, I used to be really obsessed with that book. Because it's just absolutely... How does it begin... It is possible that I may have had some presentiment of my fate. The opening paragraph ends with, as I backed onto the throne.
Right.
It's such a gorgeous
book. Yeah, it is. And that's a book that I need, you know, it's on my list to reread. I don't know why I keep putting it off, but I want to reread it in detail.
It's totally worth it.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure I'm going to get a lot more out of it now.
There's a manic... incredibly deep online email list for it called Earth, URTH.
Okay.
And they have, I mean, like, there are people on there who are scholars who have published, you know, pamphlets and articles and books on Wolf, and it's really rich. They've got a ton of stuff.
Have you read short fiction by Gene Wolfe?
Yeah, I think he's a master.
He's just stunning. Sometimes I just finish a story and I'm just like, my goodness,
I'll just vibrate with him because he'll just go in some direction that I could not have anticipated without a single word missed. He has no exposition, which is incredibly hard to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his short stories are just like, here's what's happening. And you have to infer it. I mean, it's incredibly a real high wire act that he pulled off.
Yeah, I remember in the Book of the New Sun, one of the things that he does is he counts on you to be able to remember things more than other authors do. So he says, okay, well, back on page 50 in volume 1, I mentioned this person. And here I am on page 150 of book 2. And here's this person again, and I hope you remember who it is, you know?
Yeah. He's messing with you because it's a book about memory.
Exactly.
He seems to have perfect memory, but not necessarily.
yeah. It's a masterpiece.
And once you know that detail, it's almost like, okay, I have to start over again. Because now that I know that, it changes everything.
Yeah. Exactly.
You could just keep reading it and then starting over.
Yep.
There's a little bit in there where the Severian is underground going through a gallery of ancient.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say. Go ahead.
And the world is so old that civilizations have risen and fallen all over the Earth's surface, so much so that you can't dig anywhere on Earth without hitting a building or a ship. So they don't build tall buildings anymore. They just sprawl them over. And you realize as the book goes on that the city where the main character appears for the first time isn't buildings. It's actually grounded ancient spacecraft that they're just knocked together and inhabiting. But he finds these paintings, and one of them is he describes this painting, and it freaks him out because it doesn't make any sense. There's a man wearing some weird kind of white armor, and it's all white, a little dusty. And his visor is totally reflective. It's a mirror. And behind him, it's nighttime, this incredibly black night. And next to him is a flag of some ancient country. But the flag is weird. It looks like a cartoon. It's like totally stiff. It's not flapping or anything. And it stuck with him. He couldn't figure out why. And I'm reading this. I had the hairs in the back of my neck went up. What am I seeing? And a couple of pages later, he asked me, it's a photo of a man on the moon. But so much time, so many thousands and thousands of years have gone by that you wouldn't recognize it. It's not iconic or anything at that point, you know?
I just love that, too.
That's
a book that you just unravel.
Yeah.
You can just keep reading that and reading that book.
I'll tell you what I don't like to read in audiobooks, setting aside quality of reading. You know, some nonfiction, and I was thinking of it today, trying to figure out how to describe this, nonfiction that feels referential. By that I mean not a reference book. That's kind of dull to read usually, but something where I need to flip back and forth and keep checking things out. So it's 100 years right now since the beginning of World War I. I've been reading a lot of books of World War I and find maps are essential. You think it'd be obvious, but it's really not. You'll find if you go through reviews of history books that often a complaint will be the maps aren't good, there aren't enough maps, they're not high quality. And I find that if I'm listening to an account of a battle or diplomatic maneuver, I really want to have a map nearby so I can see where these things are. And I can't do that with audiobooks. In fact, I've been buying some history books in print just so I can get maps.
Oh, cool.
Because my Kindle e-reader, they don't come out very well. I guess that's, if I'm reading philosophy, I'm happy to listen to it. If I've a biography, all kinds of nonfiction. But I think, I don't know, maybe it's just history, for which that's the case.
Yeah, I enjoy history audiobooks. You know, when I'm working, I often do programming. I also wire things. If I'm wiring something, I can always listen to something. As long as I'm alone while I'm wiring it. But when I'm doing something else, I usually like to have something going on just kind of to drown out what's going on around me. And I can't listen to fiction that way at all. It just doesn't work. You know, I completely lose the thread of everything. But I can usually listen to a nonfiction book. Like, I remember listening to Ghost in the Wires by Kevin Mitnick while programming. I had a big job to do, so I'm sitting here tapping away, but it was always in my ears. Yeah. Well, I was secretly hacking. I just looking for tips. But that book was full of things. It was more like, what do you call it when it's kind of a social thing almost that he was doing. I mean, he would call somebody up and say, "Hey, I'm calling from this office and I need this piece of information."
Social engineering.
In social engineering, right. That's what I'm, yeah. Most of the stuff that he did was like that. But yeah, I found it a fascinating book. But yeah, I was just going to mention, I'm looking up really quick. An audiobook that I absolutely love. It's written for kids, but the first time I heard it, I just love it. And both my kids have really loved it. It's called A Little History of the World by E.H. Gombrich. And it is a terrific audiobook. Really terrific. Well worth it. It's a nice introduction to the history of the world. I got a lot out of it. So I wanted to mention that while you're talking about history, but there's a couple of chapters that are really poetic, and I think my daughter has listened to chapter one like 20 times. talks about time and what time looks like. You know, if you drop if you light something on fire and you drop it into a well and you can see it falling down the well and it getting dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, that's kind of like history. Us looking back at history, and it's just very poetic, very well done.
Oh, okay. So here I'm listening to you guys talking about books and reading, and every so often my hands leap to the keyboard and open a tab for Goodreads or Google or Amazon, and I'm just adding these things to it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not always in a position to do that. I'm not always with my keyboard to hand. So this is a nice thing.
It is neat.
I'm keeping a list.
I was in a great bookstore in San Francisco. It was a science fiction bookstore, Borderlands, and it was just awesome. I mean, terrific, just wonderful place. I really recommend it if you're thinking of SF. It was great. And I was in there and I was thinking, this is the nightmarish, the worst possible book experience when you're in a bookstore, is you think, I'm thinking of a book, I can't remember the author or the title. Can you help me find it? And Jenny, it's like the reference conversation. It's more like a reference conversation plus a Ouija board, right? And you have to what are you thinking of? And
there's some really great listservs for that, by the way, for Reader's Advisory, is what we call it in librarian land. Can pose a question like that, and people jump in. It's amazing.
Oh, see, I would love to be on both sides of that now. Oh, yeah. I would love to be
that. It's an orange cover, something about space.
Yep. it's about this big, Yeah. So,
That's cool.
I just lost that story where I was going.
cool.
I mean, so I'm in this bookstore, and there's a Welsh horror novelist, and I was really impressed by him, and there was this book by him I wanted to read. But I can't think of the title, I can't think of the guy's name. So they did an interesting thing. They said, okay, hang on. They whipped out an iPad, handed it to me, and said, go to your Goodreads account. Is it in there? Yeah, it's on the right to read list. Go to it and take a look. So I quickly logged in, typed it in. There it was. And it helped that he had a very generic last name, which is Williams, and the title was too simple to remember, which is just the number one.
Mm.
Wow. But it was actually, that's a nice service to have. Just here's an iPad, go to Goodreads, pull it up, you're good.
Yeah.
I've taken to bringing a wish list with me just in case I end up at a used bookstore, because there's always the books that you just want to read in general, and you can get them from a lot of places, but then there are those books that are out of print, but you want them, and I have a list on my what I call my iPhone-ish, because it doesn't have data. and I just, every time I go to a used bookstore, I scroll through that list and I go around the store and I look for those books, and it's my ritual. Awesome.
That's cool. That's cool.
It's paid off several times.
That is one of the things that's so nice about the phone technology. We've talked about in a previous podcast about how everybody's kind of got to become their own librarian in a way, or, you know, to organize all this information. And I forgot to say, you know, as I bounce between digital and using a pen and a notebook, I found that the searchability of digital, like I use Evernote all the time. I use it at work, and I use it for most, in anything that I'm writing, I write in Evernote, not using Microsoft Word or anything like that. I use Evernote for all that stuff. And I used to think that what I do is I would write things in a journal and then I would just scan them into Evernote. But what I did instead that helps me in both worlds is to every month I'll do an index, and the index I'll put in Evernote. So it's in this book, mm-hmm. you know, if I wrote about at the mm-hmm. Mountains of Madness, it's in, you know, mm-hmm. on this date is when I wrote mm-hmm. about it. And so my index is in Evernote and searchable. I found that's a way that really works well for me.
See, I used to keep a running list, mm-hmm. and that used to be enough. But my to-read list is over 2,000 items now. So I want to read everything. So the amazing thing about Goodreads that I love is that you can have one book on multiple shelves. So now, every time right. Poetry Month comes around, I pull up a combination of to-read and poetry.
Nice. Yeah. Sorry, you guys are both mentioning Goodreads, and I'm on Goodreads. So I go through waves. I use it a lot, and then I don't use it a lot, and then I use it a lot, and I don't use it a lot. But one thing, have you guys ever heard of Library Thing?
Yeah.
I really love Library Thing. Library Thing is where I keep my collection as it is now. Everything that I have on hand, that's my database. That's where I keep it. So if I'm at a bookstore and I may, you know, if I'm like, do I have that book? You know, I don't have a ton of books, but sometimes I can't remember. But I can look at it through a Library Thing. I just really like Library Thing over Goodreads for that kind of stuff, just because it's really configurable. And maybe Goodreads is configurable in a way that I haven't discovered, but I just like, it's almost like a raw database Library Thing.
Well, what I did was I created an own shelf.
Mm-hmm.
So then everything that I have in my house goes on that shelf.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to have to create my collection in more than one place. And Goodreads for me is not just about the books, but the interactions. I think mm-hmm. I probably do that a lot more than you do, possibly.
Yeah.
Like reading other people's reviews and commenting on them and responding to comments and then being involved with a lot of groups. I don't know if Library Thing even has that or not.
Yeah, Library Thing does have groups, but no, I don't really participate in them.
It's just I'm just there. That's where I am.
That's another thing that I should mention. I think that I'm in a different league from both of you two. My reading speed is probably one a week. If I do one a week, I've had a very good year. That's the speed at which I can do it, the time in which I have with my life the way it is at the moment. Would I like it to be more? Heck yeah, you know.
But that's more than 50 books a year.
Exactly. But you know, you read, I don't know, 180 or something like that. It's stunning and awesome.
Jenny's a machine, man.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Brian, I see you on Goodreads too. You read quite a bit more than me as well.
I don't know. I go back and forth. I mean, mm-hmm. I hate to say it, but in part it depends on the book. I just finished carefully reading Lawrence of Arabia's book, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which is just freakishly awesome. I mean, it's I had to savor it. I thought I could power through it. No, it was guy was an incredible stylist, and it took me off and on reading that, you know, a month, really. But some science fiction novels I'll read for fun 2 days, maybe three. But then I'll go 3 days without reading anything, and my brain will dry up.
Yeah, and I hate that. I actually get, you know, a little annoyed, you know, if I go like 3 days and I'm like, man, you know, I really want to be reading this book, and why am I not able to? That is frustrating me.
Well, I think... Yep. I get propelled forward, though, a lot from lists of things I think I should read and awards that are going to get announced soon and book clubs I'm involved with. So I think about a good half of the reading I do is kind of on the should side of things. And every year I say I'm going to read fewer things that I think I should and more things that I just want to read. But I think that line is blurred a lot. Like right now I'm racing to read as many of the Booker long list as I can before they announce the short list next week.
Oh, wow.
The long list. And
I've gotten through everything but one that I can get my hands on because some of them don't come out until later this month in the United States.
Wow. Right.
But, you know, and so there's other people reading them at the same time for the same reason. So I can have that immediate interaction with them because we're all excited about it. And so that kind of propels me forward, too. So then all these other books that I kind of meant to read, I don't know when I read those.
So your reading is really present-oriented.
Yeah, it kind of has turned into that. And then even my in-person book club, we do pretty current stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
I go back and forth. I mean, I love... you know, I'll be with the SFF audio guys. I'll be like, ah, oh, something wonderful from the 1850s. I need to pull this up. And then, and I've got all kinds of, you know, I've just been on this kick of trying to read and reread all the Frank Herbert science fiction that isn't Dune.
Cool.
And it's awesome. It's just a trip.
That's neat.
But then I'm really obsessed with what's happening now. I mean, I want to know the current field of mainstream literature, what's going on in science fiction, fantasy, and horror, and what's going on in history, and in my professional field about education and technology. I mean, I need to be, I'm like Billy Pilgrim in Slaughterhouse Five, you know, I'm loose in space time.
Yeah, yeah.
Not enough time.
Hey, so I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm still trying to read a book from every country. And that started 2 years ago. I'm never going to get there.
That's awesome.
You're so awesome.
They keep moving the map. They keep moving the lines.
I know. Soon, there's two Congos now.
Yeah. Well, soon will be two Ukraines, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny. So have you read all of the Dune novels, Brian?
All six, Frank Herbert? Yes.
Yes. What do you think... I've read Dune and Dune Messiah. Dune Messiah is a very interesting book, and I liked it, even though it's kind of an anti-hero thing.
Yeah.
What do you think of Beyond That? I have not read it.
I think nothing is anywhere close to the first book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Dune is just one of the stupendous books. You know, it's just an amazing work.
Yeah.
Dune Messiah is I really enjoy, in part because it's so different. It's a tragedy.
Yeah.
Dune is a romance. I don't mean a love romance. I mean an adventure romance, you know.
Sure, sure.
But it does have love in it. The third book is... I didn't like it the first time I read it, but it really grew on me. It's a more positive book. It ends on a very upbeat, almost grandiose note. It rewinds and does some stuff to previous characters that you may or may not like. There's some really unsettling stuff that happens. But it's interesting to see the generational shift where it really, you know, it moves on in time. So I'd recommend it.
Okay.
The fourth book is the decisive break for a lot of people because God Emperor of Dune has almost no plot action. There's a little something that happens at the beginning and a big something that happens at the end, and then most of the book is dialogues with the God Emperor. And I loved it because I just thought he was fascinating and the ideas were fascinating, and all the concepts and the weird theories that Herbert hints at and touches on finally get full expression, and you can really make arguments, and they're just really, really interesting. But you have to be aware it's a philosophical novel, so you don't expect a lot of action.
Yeah, that's a pretty big book, too.
It is. Mm-hmm. But it's... Then the fifth and the sixth books race ahead. I mean, the God Emperor of Dune takes place, I think, 1,500 years after Children of Dune. And then the fifth and sixth book take place thousands of years after that. And they're almost completely different books. There's a lot more action, a lot more stuff is going on. He brings back some old characters in ways that I can't tell still. I'm not deciding if they're good or bad to do. And the sixth book, I suspect, wasn't completely finished because I know it came out the year of his death, and it feels a little rough. There's a heartbreaking bit at the end where the fourth wall breaks, and what you get is a quiet little ode to what is obviously Herbert's wife, who had just died a couple of years before.
Oh, wow.
And if you get the trade paperback version of the book, the back cover, along all the swirls of the desert, you get Frank and Beverly.
Huh.
And it just kicks me in the head every time I see it. So each of these is different. I mean, they're really a different type of book.
Okay, cool.
So I give it a shot.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna push ahead then.
Reading Herbert always makes one smarter, I find.
Well, that's good. That's a good attribute. Very nice.
I was going to ask about Goodreads. I had two thoughts. Okay, one was, do you guys have good experiences with discussion groups?
Yeah, I definitely do.
Yeah,
Sometimes I feel like I'm in too many.
Yeah, I've very limited participation, but everything that I've done there has been positive.
Okay. Well, maybe you guys should tell me. I've been very disappointed. I joined a bunch of groups, and some of them had great ideas, and they died. I mean, I don't know if I touched them and they died. That's my suspicion.
Oh, I doubt that.
Or they may have just been defunct when I joined them. I didn't realize it, but they didn't go anywhere. And then I was active on Sword and Laser, and I've pulled way back from it, in part because there was this hate fest for one of my favorite writers, Stanislaw Lem, and so I was worried that I would become too obnoxious about their lack of understanding and lack of taste. But also, I don't get a lot of interaction. I mean, I'll post what I'm reading, and no one says anything, or I'll post a comment. I don't get a lot back. And then if I just passively consume and look what people are saying, it's I guess I can hear this on Twitter. I mean, it's like, you know, random dive into science fiction and fandom. It doesn't. I don't know. I like the podcast interviews they've done, or which are now video. But the discussion, I was hoping for a lot more.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that group up, because the next episode of Reading Envy, I'm talking to two people who've been in Sword and Laser like from the beginning. So I think it'll be interesting to hear what they have to say too. I'm not as involved in there as I used to be. I think part of it is the occasional hate fest that I just can't stand. And I feel that way about the internet in general. I've actually unfollowed a lot of people on Twitter for a similar reason. But then also, I mean, the group changes and it grows and it's so big now. And there's certain people that I really like to hear their opinions on things. But honestly, I get their opinions better through their reviews. So I'm just not active in there every day like I used to be. But I think some of the groups I'm in are more about deeper discussion. I think probably the best one is the On the Southern Literary Trail group. And they pick two books a month, one before 1980, one after. And I can never read as much as they do. At least I just haven't made it a priority. But they just get really deep into the discussion. Lots of stuff, lots of people participating. It's not just the shallow, I like that, I didn't like that kind of stuff that I often see in Sword and Laser. So that's been a really good one. I think my actual best online book club experiences, though, have been outside of Goodreads, now that I think about it. Like my Misfit Readers group in Facebook. That one's probably the best one I've been in.
That's a Facebook group.
Yeah, and I think it's a secret group, you know, so no one else sees when you're leaving a comment, like everything else in Facebook. I think that somehow made a difference, because people could be really personal about their experiences with something and what it meant to them. Somehow it made a difference, even if it's a kind of a faux privacy issue. I don't know.
Do you, now that, but it used to be a secret group, but now you've outed them.
Oh, well, anyone can request to join. I think you can still find it. But like I think that...
That's great.
Yeah. Well, we started just reading Infinite Jest together, and then it kind of jumped ship, and they started a new group so that they could keep going and not just talk about that book.
Mm-hmm.
And so different people have picked the books, and then they lead everyone through that process. So there is a little ebb and flow there for how invested the person leading it is and how much everyone else is into the book they've picked. But for the most part, I felt like that's been really good. And they added little things in, like Google Hangout chats and blogging. But I think the most effective part was just the discussion in Facebook, and anyone could start a new topic. And that got really interesting. Although they're reading War and Peace, and I stopped.
Oh, no! Don't! Where were you? Do you remember?
Well, I think I was on around page 400 or so. Honestly, it's a format issue. I need to go out and buy myself the print book because I'm just not connecting with it as an ebook. I get frustrated when I have to go back and forth with the translation elements and the little footnotes. Because it doesn't work very well on Kindle either. I'm not clicking on the right spot. I'm not really sure what it is. Oh,
I hate
it's awful.
On the Kindle. I hate for yeah. Kindle.
So I just need to get a print book so that I'm not frustrated, and then I'll get back into it. Because I was enjoying it.
Oh. You know, someone tagged me with this thing on Facebook. Pick 10 books that made the biggest influence on you. Have you guys seen this?
I haven't seen it. Go ahead.
It's too overwhelming. I can't pick.
So they say, you know, pick 10 books that have had the most influence on you in your life. And they can be anything. Don't think of the quality. Just think, and don't think too hard. You think of like the first 10 that really come to mind. And actually, I overthought it and started writing. So I actually had to do a blog response to it. But one
that's a good idea.
Well, I have to. It's going to be really pompous and introverted and sad and no one else. But one of those books is for me is War and Peace, because in junior high I had eighth grade, I think, I had a teacher tell me I couldn't read it because I wasn't up to it.
Huh.
And so I said, well, damn it, I have to read now. You know, I made a point of it and powered through the entire book, maybe understanding about a third of it. You know, And it blew me away because it's such an incredible book. And then every few years, I go back and read parts of it. And after my kids are born, I've been reading parts out loud to them because it's just so astonishing. In fact, I once as an undergrad, I actually got involved in a spectacular drinking accident involving a scene from the beginning of War and Peace. You remember this part with Dolokhov and the bottle of brandy in the open window?
Yeah, because it's near the beginning.
Yes. Yes, I don't recommend doing it, but no, I've seen both the Soviet movie and the American movie, and I never watched the American movie. It is horrible. It is totally wrong. It's just Yeah, the Russian movie is pretty good. It gives a good, and there are chunks of it on YouTube that you can pull up. But sorry. See, this is the thing: is that books do this to us. They
yes,
yeah, absolutely.
They reach into our guts and they summon up our passions and. You know, it's hard to avoid that.
Yeah,
and you know, there's nothing that can drive me forward in a book more than a reaction like that from a friend. Like, what? You have to read this, or you can't stop reading this. Or the other day, I reviewed a Philip Roth book because I want to read him this year. I just never have. Mm-hmm. And they were like, I can't believe that's the book you picked. That was the wrong book.
Oh, what'd you pick?
So, you know. I just picked Deception because I had it. I'd found it at a used book sale or something. But he was like, no, that's the wrong era. You have to go read this other book instead. I was like, fine.
did they tell you to report noise complaint?
That one or American Pastoral or The Plot Against America. But I had read The Plot Against America already.
Oh, you had? Okay.
That's I don't remember it.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Ooh, and you don't remember it. Oh,
I know, because it was like, maybe 10 years ago.
Well, yeah. I guess this brings me to my second bill of attainder against Goodreads, and that's recommendations. You know, I'm a prickly person to do recommendations for, because I read a lot, and my tastes are weird. And I know my wife has long since given up on buying me books because she's always afraid that she'll give me something and I'll hate it or I'll already have three copies of it or something. So I was really excited about Goodreads for the recommendation perspective, but I find I get zero from the recommendations of Goodreads, the automated ones. You know, uh-huh. I much prefer Amazon. You know, the people who bought this also bought that. I find much more reliable, much more useful. But
now that Amazon owns Goodreads, shouldn't those things be the same?
They haven't integrated them yet, though.
Oh, okay. You know, it's funny because I get plenty of recommendations from Goodreads, but I'm not using the engine. I'm using the reviews of the friends I have there that like the same things I like.
Right. I love, I get this daily email digest, which is activity from your friends at Goodreads.
Yeah, I love it.
And there's like, someone read this, someone read this. And here's Jenny who read these 12 books last night. And then there's three.
It's not true.
And it's great because it tells me about these people, what they're interested in and what they're reading. And then, the comments will be great. And, I have a lot of friends who will read a book star it on Goodreads, but not say anything else about it. And that's actually a little tiny bit of information. Then I can ping them and say, hey, why only 2 stars for that? Does it suck? So you're not using the system. You're using the people.
Yeah, just the people. I find that to be more effective.
Yeah, me too.
Just today, I got an email from someone that said, I'm packing my books for Paris, and I noticed that you abandoned this book that I was planning to bring with me. Can you tell me why?
And you said first, you're going to Paris with books and I hate you.
Right? Well, she's trying to bring all books that are set there, which I think is brilliant.
Huh. Well, that's a fun idea.
Yeah.
That's a fun. There's a lot of books set there.
Heck yeah.
Absolutely.
There's an essay by the great German critic Walter Benjamin called Unpacking My Library. And I used to, when we used to move a lot, I would read it and reread it because it was so nice. Because he never finishes unpacking the library in the essay. He just talks about opening a box and, oh, that book. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. No, what about this one? Let me just sit down and look at it for a minute and hours go by. I'm always sympathetic to that.
I'm going to go find that one.
Yeah.
I think the hardest thing about recommendations and about the social aspect of reading is unless I have a formal structure, I find it really hard to talk with people about books. I mean, it's easy for me to get going, but I'm always nervous about what type of commentary to take. So, if there's a structure, teaching a class or as a little kid, filling out a book report, that was easy. But if I just meet a person on the street and they say, oh, you're reading this book, what do you think? All right, should I talk like an academic? Should I assume this person knows what this is? Do I need to make excuses? And when I'm in social media, I find it's odd. I'll try and take a very general democratic tone, and then I'll get either ignored by my academic friends or they will write in an academic way, and I'll feel kind of embarrassed, that I've talked below them. And it feels awkward. Does this make sense? I'm not being very coherent. I'm sorry.
No. I think you are. Yeah, is it a cool moment, though? Have you ever been in a bookstore? Well, clearly both of you have been in a bookstore, too. But to have someone, you're pulling a book out or something like that, and someone may say something about, ooh, I really like that one. And that's just an instant connection. And then you start to talk.
Yeah.
It's happened to me several times. And then you just start talking, and it's, like I said, just an instant connection with that person.
Yeah.
And I find that very rewarding.
Yeah.
I do think in general, though, I definitely have those moments where I'm like, I don't sound smart enough, or I don't sound like I know enough. And I just have to repeat the mantra, what other people think of me is none of my business. What other people think of me is none of my business. Because if someone really wants to know what I think, it's going to maybe not be the most balanced and informed, but it's going to be my reaction to a book. And that's kind of how I approach, at least the reviews that I write, they're definitely not that academic in nature. But when I'm talking to people about books, I often try to get them to explain more why they like the books they do, because then you can kind of figure out what it is they're looking for in the books they read and what might interest them in the books that you're reading. But
well, that's like a, you know, criticism versus talking about books, which is something that Jo Walton has talked about. And I just like how she puts it. You know, she says, "I'm not a critic. I'm not trying to be a critic. I just like to talk about books." And that's how I view myself too. You know, I'm not here to try and direct the genre in a certain direction or influence it in any way. I'm just here to talk about what I'm reading and the connections that I find, that I find so rewarding. And, you know, that's why I'm here. It's just, it's not to criticize or try to tear down or try to direct, which I think a lot of people do. Especially, you know, whether there's a whole, you know, the whole criticism, I mean, it's a profession, right? You know, in the New York Times and everything. So, I just have never viewed myself that way. I admit that at times I felt like I could go down that road. And at times when I was starting, I was thinking, boy, could I go down that road? But I just, I can't do that. I was never comfortable doing that. I don't know how many times I've reviewed a book that I personally didn't like, but yet at the same time I can see, well, a fan of military science fiction might like this. And, and that's what I would say in the review. You know, I wouldn't give it a bunch of stars or anything. I would just say, maybe I wasn't the right person to do this, but that would be in the review. I would just say that maybe I'm not the person to review this, but, you know, if you like military science fiction, they talk a lot about hardware in this. So, you know, thumbs up, thumbs up for you, you know, but not for me.
But so you're talking about the, you're thinking, Scott, about the audience and the audiences, the multiple ones, the multiple possible readers or interlocutors who'd be talking to you.
Yeah.
And Jenny, you've got the, you're thinking of it from the, from your side, you know, the, my reaction to this book, and that's the important thing, you know, getting it out there. You know, it's a nice combination to have together. It's, I mean, you guys just articulated a good model, I think, of how to respond to books.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. And you too.
Well, I'm much nicer in print than I am out loud. I don't know why. I mean, in print, I think I come across as very sober and kind of positive and humorless. And out loud, I prefer to make jokes. And I also get, you know, I lunge at things. It's a start. I don't know how to cross that barrier or if I should. But when I talk about books, I'm happy to dismiss them. I mean, like, I never bother writing about how much I hate Piers Anthony, for example, you know, right? I don't bother saying, God, stop him now, you know. But I do out loud, you know. I like what you say about the different audiences. And I've been reviewing a mystery writer who I just found, and I feel like I'm still just wading into the mystery genre, and I'm always careful to say, you know, I don't want to say, the ending really surprised me. I thought it was really well done, and I'm waiting for every mystery reader to say, oh, come on. That was old hat in the 1930s. Everyone, you know. I should think about, you know, say, if you're reading this, if you're a mystery fan, you know, this might be really good for you. If you're new to mysteries, then, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
At the same time, I've been following a few authors who've had books just come out recently, both Darren Bradley and Jeff Vandermeer. And it's really funny to read their responses to what reviewers say, especially when they're comparing them to other authors. Like, what? How do you get Chuck Palahniuk? You know, things like that. So, I mean, well, I think that's important for us to understand. I guess, what am I trying to say? I would think more about who the reader is when I see things like that, that tells me about their own reading history and maybe what it is in the book they're connecting with. Maybe not so much about exactly where to place the author. But I think that's valuable information, though.
You're drawing so heavily on the powerful wellsprings of your profession. I mean, this brings up Regan Ethon's comment, right? To every book, it's reader.
Yeah.
There's a... I think it's... It is fun to read. It's like it's fun to read reviews now. It's also fun to go back and read historical reviews of things that, you know, classics that get savaged and... Mm-hmm. And then books that are celebrated that we don't touch anymore. You know, that's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All the discussion around it is. There's a podcast I listen to from Slate, and actually a couple of podcasts, and I listen to them partly because they drive me crazy. They have some really bright people, but they hate science fiction, fantasy, horror. They cannot stand it, and they're proud of it. And then they every so often have to review a book or a movie, and the contempt just comes off of them in waves. And for some reason, for some perverse reason, I don't know, maybe it's my Russian ancestry, I enjoy this, you know, in part. I find it instructive. It tells me about, you know, American culture now and different attitudes, and that's pretty useful. But also just reminds me of what it means to read a certain genre or to know a certain genre. You know, it does put you in a, maybe not a ghetto, but definitely puts you in one side. And that's different from reading, you know, mainstream fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to talk about Chuck Palahniuk, you know, he's open for everybody, right? I mean, if you don't like him, it's a personal taste thing. It's not because he's been pigeonholed in this one subsection of the library.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the other day, have you guys ever seen, what was the name of that spinoff series to Battlestar Galactica? Caprica.
I loved Caprica.
A lot of really deep philosophical science fiction ideas in Caprica.
Really?
Yeah. I thought it was terrific.
Oh, okay.
I have very few space battles.
Unfortunately, it was canceled, so it stops. But I think it's well worth watching. But someone was telling me about their experience with that the other day, and I said, you know, science fiction is like that. It's not... like, you know, space battles and things. And we got into a conversation about science fiction and how, you know, this is the kind of stuff that science fiction has been addressing, you know, for 40, 50 years, these kind of themes. And that person was a little surprised by that.
Yeah, the nature of reality and the nature of humanity and all those things are in there.
Yeah,
absolutely. No, I loved.
It was a good piece of science fiction. Yeah, Caprica was good science fiction in my opinion.
Thanks.
So was Battlestar Galactica. I loved it.
Well, the last season of Battlestar Galactica drove me nuts, especially the end, and so that kind of soured me on it. But I loved the first few seasons. I thought they were extraordinary. So, well, thank you.
Yeah,
and good for you. Good for you, getting people to see science fiction in a better light. Good for you.
Heck yeah, yeah. People have a view of what it is, and. It's not just Guardians of the Galaxy. There's other stuff, too.
Well, that was fun.
Yeah, it was a fun movie. But, yeah.
My son... Oh, here's a different thing. My son is 16. I have no idea how that happened. But my son is 16. How old is are your children, Scott?
My son is 19.
And, whoa!
Yeah.
So is my daughter. Wow.
And my daughter is 14.
Wow, we're almost parallel.
Yeah.
So I find, responding to books and movies now, I'm totally different than I was 20 years ago because I have another eye open for how they will respond to books.
Yeah.
You know, I'm constantly thinking about, would Owen like this or would Gwyneth like this? And that's so different. You know, I'm watching or screening a lot more classic movies at home. And now, thanks to my son, I'm reading a lot more alternate history, and you'll appreciate this, Scott. Mm. More military science fiction, thanks to him.
Yeah.
That's what he's into.
Cool.
And that really changes. You know, it's totally destroyed our Netflix recommendation. You know, it's like,
you know,
do you want to watch this Russian documentary or G.I. Joe versus Cobra? Which one? You know?
I spent a lot of years when they were younger reading what they read. You know, uh-huh. they want to read Hunger Games, you know, by all means,
yeah.
You know, and I would read it, and I would, you know, read The Giver, and
yeah.
I'm trying to think of something. I even read Twilight.
Oh, God, you strong man.
Yeah, but it was, there's something about it. Again, it has to do with connection. You know, to have a shared novel, there's just
yeah.
something deeper about that than having a shared movie. Although, you know, a shared movie is good too, but
yeah.
there's just something about the depth of a story that's in a novel that when you share that with your kids,
totally.
There's just something about it that's, you know, you can't describe it, but I mean, it's the same with other people, not just your kids, but again, that instant connection.
Yeah, I really am a fan of reading people's favorite books and then, you know, trying to get to know them that way.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever done that? It's a really interesting exercise.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's driven me away from some people.
sure.
But it tells me a lot more. You know, you get to dive into their brain at a different level.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
And just to have the shared thing, you know, if you, you know, you're at a grocery store and something happens and you look at each other and you both know what you're thinking at the same time, you know, that's,
mm-hmm.
there's nothing
mm-hmm.
better than that. You know, where you're like, oh, yeah.
My daughter was a huge, and is a huge fan of this Irish young adult fantasy series called Skullduggery Pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Which is terrific. And I don't know why it doesn't have a huge fan base in the U.S. I really can't tell. It's about two people, a teenage girl who takes the nom de guerre of Valkyrie Kane. And her name's Stephanie, but, you know, she likes that name. And her partner in detective work is an animated skeleton named Skullduggery Pleasant.
Hmm.
And they both get to, every book, they get to investigate something involving magic and myth and craziness. And the books are extremely funny. Tons and tons of action. The author apparently teaches martial art, you can tell. And they're scary. I mean, they get increasingly more towards horror as they go on.
Wow.
And so my daughter was a huge fan of these. Has these all, like, British hardcovers imported from across the Atlantic. And so she made me read them, and I really liked them. And so we were reading along. And now we have that bond where we can only say, oh, you know, that's just like the interaction between these two characters or this. So
yeah.
She's away at college now. We just took her there last month. And so I'm still trying to recover from this. And she emails me a bunch of drawings she's done of characters from these books. And they're beautiful. I mean, they're really striking and moving. So we had an email exchange about them. And then she won't let me show them to anybody else, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But she did give me permission to put them on my phone.
Oh,
so
nice.
I've got two of these drawings. And as I walk around, I've got this drawing. And it connects me to when my daughter was 14 or 16, to conversations we've had. It just connects right to our two hearts. It sounds cheesy, but it's just the way it feels.
No, it's just terrific. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, my avatar on Twitter was drawn by my daughter. It is Sherlock Holmes in a cartoon.
Oh, nice.
A cartoon of Sherlock Holmes, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Thumbs up. But again, you know, I mean, these connections are with people too. And I think that that's what I reach for. And that's why I do this. That's why I met Jenny. Right?
So true.
SFF Audio is where we met.
That's how I met her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is weird because I've met like everybody around her in her work.
I know. At two of my places of employment.
Wait, yeah. What was the place? What was the other place?
DePauw.
That's right. You're at DePauw.
Yeah, I was in instructional technology there.
I know everybody there. Everybody.
There. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, SFF Audio is some kind of a vortex. something. Because I when I first met Julie, I was following her blog, and I didn't realize that the Julie that was on this podcast I was just on was the same person. until one day the light came on and I was like, this is the same person. How funny was that? Yeah. That was good stuff.
The best friends I have are because of reading in various ways.
That's cool. Yeah.
We're all people of the book, in that sense.
People of the book. Yeah. Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.